Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. I'm your host, Greg Kubin.
And I'm your co-host, Matthias Serbrinski.
We're partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health technologies. This episode was recorded live at a panel moderated by Matthias at the Soho House in New York in November 2022. This is actually part two of a moderated panel from the Soho House. Part one was released in June of 2022. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, you can find it on your Business Trip podcast feed with the title, The State of Psychedelics with Dr. Rachel Yehuda and Zach Hagemy. In today's episode, we welcome back Rachel and Zach. Rachel has spent the last 30 years doing research on PTSD and trauma, and is leading the MDMA-assisted therapy research that's being done at the James J. Peters VA Medical Center in the U.S. She's also the director of the Mount Sinai Center of Psychotherapy and Trauma Research in New York. Zach is the founder of a popular newsletter called The Trip Report by Beckley Waves about the business, policy, and science of psychedelics. He started writing The Trip Report in 2019 and quickly grew its readership by analyzing psychedelic news headlines from every angle. This panel is a little different than our typical interviews, since it was a live conversation in front of an audience. We cover many important topics that the psychedelic ecosystem is currently talking about, including whether the hype around psychedelics has gotten ahead of the science, the opportunities and limitations of clinical trials, and the impact of psychedelic legislative approvals in Oregon and Colorado. And we also invite the audience to ask questions to the panelists. So please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Rachel Yehuda and Zach Hagemy, moderated by Matthias.
Well, we're doing this live. We may as well take advantage of it and make it a little bit more interactive than the typical podcast recording. So if you have questions, raise your hand, and the people that know me here, text me your questions. Last time we talked a lot about MDMA, PTSD. We discussed what the psychedelic landscape looks like today. I want to start by going into a different molecule, drug, medicine. We have all these different names for the same, which is psilocybin. So Rachel, I know that you just initiated phase two studies for the treatment of PTSD with psilocybin. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that and what is different and what's similar than MDMA and what we know and what we do not know about it.
Well, thank you. And it's great to be here with everybody tonight. So you've asked me to talk about the similarities and differences between MDMA and psilocybin for PTSD. And I don't really know the answer to that because there hasn't been a clinical trial yet, proper clinical trial evaluating psilocybin in PTSD, although some might be in the works. It's out there in the stratosphere that psilocybin is good for trauma, and maybe it is, but we're going to be doing the research and then we'll share the findings. But there's no reason to believe that psilocybin and MDMA work the same way because they're actually very different experiences. When we began our trial with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, I really understood why the MDMA was an important assist for a psychotherapeutic process. MDMA is not a classic psychedelic. It doesn't really cause ego dissolution. It's more of a heart opener. It induces a lot of self-compassion. It reduces fear, promotes insight and introspection, and also creates trust with the therapist. So when MDMA is used in a psychotherapy session, eight-hour-long medication session, really you have the opportunity of the MDMA helping to create an environment of openness so that difficult material can be discussed. And that's exactly what happens in an MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session. After some preparation, you have an MDMA session where generally over the course of the 8 hours, several of those hours will be therapy hours where the patient is talking and the therapists are doing the psychotherapy that is required to support the patient's process. And then there's integration. But with a classic psychedelic like psilocybin, there's typically not a lot of talking that goes on during the actual medication session. And so to me, that became a really intriguing question of what would happen. There's certainly a very similar inner process of confronting material that is usually inaccessible. And then most of what happens, at least with the therapist, happens after the session. So yes, there is the same process of preparation where there are discussions about what is going to happen during the medication session, what kind of interventions are pre-agreed upon, touching, no touching, walking through and stepping through, what might happen under the influence of a medicine, etc. But during the session, it might be very different. Now, afterwards, in integration, who knows, maybe it's a very similar process where the patient and the therapist can really have quite a detailed conversation about insights that were gleaned during the altered state, but that remains to be determined. And I think it will be very, very interesting and exciting.
Zach, can you contextualize a little bit more psilocybin in the sense of where there is more data, where there's more research in terms of other indications?
Yeah, so much of the MDMA research is born out of the MAPS project, which is at the phase 3 trial of the FDA approval process. Psilocybin in what's called investigator-initiated trials or academic research. So it's not for the purpose of drug development to get FDA approval. There is end-of-life anxiety. There is alcohol use disorder. There is treatment-resistant depression, which there's major depressive disorder. So there's a handful of indications that psilocybin has been evaluated for at various stages of clinical trials. Relevantly, Compass Pathways is the commercial developer of a synthetic psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression. They just announced their phase 3 trial design, which will start in the next month or two. So the way I see it, there's a wider swath of indications that has been evaluated for psilocybin, but still all in the earlier stages of development.
Yeah, and the only study that I'm aware of where psilocybin was compared with the standard of care, the results were not what many people would have expected. And so one of the reasons I'm saying this is that, sure, there's many things that look good, but there's also so many open questions. And so I'm curious if one of you two can discuss what that study looked like, or at least what they were trying to show.
You're talking about a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that compared psilocybin to escitalopram, which is the standard of care for depression and maybe even treatment-resistant depression. And it was a complicated design, to say the least, and it was a very courageous study to do. And the way that clinical trials are conducted, the investigator establishes a primary outcome measure and declares it in advance, and then also may be interested in a bunch of other measures that are deemed the secondary outcome measure. And in this particular study, psilocybin did not outperform escitalopram on the primary measure, but it did on all the other measures. And so that's a tough situation to be in, because in your heart you say, but this treatment did so much good in so many other measures. But the way that the clinical trials field works is that you have to base the official conclusion based on the primary outcome measure. So there was a lot of blogging and a lot of talking and a lot of discussion and all that. So I think
a lot of tweeting.
A lot of tweeting and all that. And, you know, to me, and I've said this before, I think even to Robin Carhart-Harris, who's one of the lead authors, that even showing that psilocybin is as good as the standard of care is such a big deal, because there are potential benefits of psychedelics that are not found in the standard of care. Maybe there are fewer side effects. Maybe you have to take the drug for a shorter period of time. It was courageous to do that kind of a head-to-head comparison, and most of the studies that are being done are placebo-controlled trials. And of course, we know that most people can tell whether they have active drug or placebo in these clinical trials. So I think that we have to keep the perspective, not only in terms of what happens in the short term of these trials, but what happens a year later. You know, these primary and secondary outcomes can be really tricky because when you're trying to collect data on a particular disorder or condition, you know, like depression or PTSD, we choose scales that are really ways of measuring the severity of those symptoms of those conditions. But we may not say, so how do you feel about life, right? How do you wake up in the morning? Do you take your kids out to the movies now, right? So a lot of the gains that people say they have or changes that people make in their lives are not necessarily captured on the scales that we use in research. And we don't capture a lot of information after the study period. And I can tell you now that we're in the middle of our MDMA trial, you know, the endpoint almost comes too soon, but we continue to see patients afterwards. And, you know, over time, people look even better sometimes than they looked as the gains are being consolidated.
Yeah, that in a way matches a more naturalistic view of psychedelics. To put it differently, how psychedelics have been used for a really long time, where people may keep coming back, right? Once every 3 months to have a journey, once every 6 months or whatever is agreed upon the therapeutic alliance. And so it feels like both from the indication perspective, but also from what's the protocol, we need to play by FDA rules because that's how things will get approved. But I wonder how much that reflects what is the individual experience of a patient.
To that point, outside of the clinical trial, FDA approval, scientific endeavor, there are state-level policy reforms that are happening. And most notably today, Colorado is voting on a proposition that would legalize and decriminalize. Oregon also has a bill that was passed by voters in 2020 that goes into effect in January. And I think what's hoped from these types of situations is an opportunity for naturalistic or real-world data gathering, an understanding of what it looks like, quote-unquote, in the wild, you might say, even though these would be a far cry from the true wild.
Anything to add, Rachel, to that?
Yeah, I mean, when you have a naturalistic experiment, as will be had in Oregon, there's no way of knowing whether we're going to get all the information, particularly the adverse events. So I think that that's a concern. I think that there's no obligation to report them to anybody. And we tend to focus on positive outcomes. People like to tell their story when things improve for them. And when people go to therapy, they don't necessarily go to see someone because they have a specific diagnosis. They go because they have a problem that they need to be solved. They're not feeling well. They need some help. They may not even think they have a diagnosis or know what their diagnosis is. So there's kind of a, you know, there's this gap between what happens in the world of clinical research and what happens in the world of clinical practice. In Oregon, it's not even about clinical anything. It's just about the fact that certain psychedelics are going to be made available. And a lot of the people that will want to try them may not be trying them for any reasons having to do with mental health. They're not available necessarily for those reasons. So I think that the conversation sometimes gets very confounded because people that are looking to investigate the utility of psychedelics in mental health are really talking a very different language than people that think that psychedelics should be broadly available for a wide range of purposes, depending on a lot of different circumstances that may include a mental health condition or a problem, but is not necessarily so. One literature does not generalize to the other use. And if there are adverse events that are going to occur in Oregon, I hope there's a way that we can learn about them. But I'm not sure that we will get the data from this naturalistic experiment.
Maybe we can explore what have we learned so far from the clinical trials that have been done either with, you know, psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression or MDMA for PTSD. And so maybe let's start with a basic question. Do we know for whom this works and for whom this doesn't work?
Not particularly. I don't think that we have a good answer to that question. What you have to understand about clinical research is that in order to be a participant in a study, we have to be qualified to participate. And what that means is that there are a set of inclusion and exclusion criteria, literally a checklist of you have to have this, that, and the other thing, but you can't have the following. So some examples of inclusion criteria would be for a PTSD study, you would need to have PTSD or have an identifiable trauma. Sometimes you have to be within a certain age or something like that. An exclusion criteria might be that you have another condition outside of PTSD. Maybe you have a traumatic brain injury, or maybe you have bipolar disorder, or maybe you're currently addicted to substances that might make you ineligible to participate in the study. Or maybe you are living in a circumstance where there is ongoing violence, so that if your PTSD symptoms, you know, do abate, they might be in danger of coming back because of your ongoing circumstance. So the people that are in trials may not necessarily represent the universe of people that might try a certain therapy. And even within a highly controlled trial, we generally focus on saying things like, well, the drug was significantly better than the placebo condition. We don't necessarily focus on, well, here are the responders versus the non-responders, and here are the characteristics of the responders versus the characteristics of the non-responders. These can be potentially assessed by doing a lot of baseline measures before the treatment gets started, or even evaluating people after the trial to see if there are any fundamental differences. In our work, we do a lot of biologic studies before and after a trial, as well as psychological studies, because for the last 15 years, we've been interested in this idea of who responds to what treatment, even predating any interest that I ever had in psychedelics. The one thing that just dawned on us a long time ago was that there's no one approach that is good for everyone within a certain diagnostic category, and that this idea of trying to match people to a particular treatment was really where the field needed to go next. In my despair of not feeling that there were very powerful treatments, I kind of bumped into the psychedelic movement and MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. And the data were so good that we decided to see for ourselves, particularly in a very difficult-to-treat population, which are combat veterans with chronic PTSD. And so we're in the middle of that trial, and I can tell you that we developed that trial anticipating that there would be non-responders as well as responders, and being completely armed to try to use every biologic tool at our disposal as well as psychologic tools to see if we can predict this in advance, or in retrospect after the fact, see if the responders differ in a fundamental way from the non-responders, because that's what I think we have to be doing right now. And, you know, for FDA approval and for raising capital for industry and investment, we don't talk about non-responders. We talk about responders. We talk about how great this is. We talk about large effect sizes. But if we're really going to try to do things differently and have a renaissance and try to really improve over the past, then I think we need to take this approach that not everybody is suited for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, and really go in there trying to figure out who is best suited to do this.
Do you have any sense of where those questions are taking you based on data that you're allowed to talk about?
Well, I can tell you for treatments other than psychedelics, because this has been the work that we have done, we've been able to identify some epigenetic changes that might predict response to psychotherapy or be associated with improvements in psychotherapy. We've been able to see that there are certain hormonal or biologic chemical markers that can do the same. We did this on a specific candidate epigenetic level as well as epigenome level, and we've published these papers. So the idea was to, for PTSD, again, that's where our work has concentrated, to see if we can use some of the knowledge about biologic changes that have been associated with PTSD to see if some of those also predict response, or maybe other things predict response. We're at a very interesting time in neuroscience because it is relatively easy to measure a lot of things at once from a very small volume of blood, or to be able to do brain imaging and really look at a lot of different features of brain activity, both at baseline or in response to challenges. And we're constantly developing new ways to look at this. So to me, doing these kinds of clinical studies without looking at some of these markers, it seems like a real missed opportunity, because running a clinical trial is really, really hard. And taking a blood sample and looking at something in the lab by comparison is really, really easy.
Basically, we're kind of throwing shit at the wall, for lack of a better phrase, in the treatment of mental health, you might say, and seeing what works. But what you're proposing and the way you're sort of advocating for is like a more precise means of establishing or, yeah, understanding who would benefit from what treatment?
Well, the neuroscience is also throwing shit at the wall in a way, because it's not a very refined approach to measure everything that can be measured. But if you keep doing it, pretty soon you amass a very big database and you can use computational methods to make some sense out of it. So no one study is going to give you the answer. That's why, you know, learning things takes time. It's a very frustrating thing to have to wait and not be able to, on your own, gather the information that is needed to tell a full story. But when you look at some of the advances that are made in, for example, genetics, it takes a village. You know, these gigantic consortia get started. Everyone agrees to share and pool and do things together. We could argue how much we have actually learned about the genetics of conditions like depression and PTSD. That would be another fun thing to have a podcast about. But the idea is that no one study would be able to get that information. So it just takes a commitment and a core belief that there are responders and non-responders. And that requires humility. It requires this idea of not thinking that you're going to have the answer, which, you know, may or may not be the best way to raise money for a new company, for example, from investors. So I think, you know, it's a different mindset.
Yeah. Speaking of investors, you touched on one of our core focus areas, which is precision psychiatry. And it sounds fantastic as a title, but then once we started going deep into, okay, you know, what is available today? What can we, you know, which entrepreneurs we can back and partner with that will bring something to the clinic? It gets a lot more complicated. It feels like things are happening, but it will take a while. I'll say it will take more than what I thought it would take. We've made some investments in the field, but it still feels extremely early. I was thinking about this idea of precision psychiatry and predicting who will be a responder. And what came for me is the research that was done at Hopkins and with psilocybin and the idea of a mystical experience and how that was a predictor of something. So I'm curious if one of you two can talk a little bit about it.
The research that you're alluding to was in treatment end-of-life anxiety, one of the early trials from Hopkins. They associated a greater response in those participants who experienced a full mystical experience, and the outcomes correlated with the intensity of the mystical experience. And so it's interesting that a subjective experience is somehow related to a treatment outcome. Do we know what to do with that?
For sure, if we can develop subjective assessments instead of molecules, that will be better and easier and more applicable in the real world. But the problem with saying that Hopkins found that people were better responders if they had mystical experiences is that it doesn't help me with the problem of whether I should give this drug to someone. So it's not a predictor, it's a correlative response. And so the holy grail, I think, is to be able to identify something, whether it's a molecule or a trait, that will help me understand whether somebody should be given this kind of therapy to begin with. But the wild card is that it's not just about the medicine. It also depends a lot on the environment, on the therapists, on how the experience is facilitated, the intention, and all of those other things. So, for example, if I wanted to predict who would do well with MDMA, am I trying to predict who would do well in a rave? Or who's going to be doing well in therapy? It's the same molecule. The questions become more complicated, but I have nothing against, in fact, encourage the explorations to be about subjective characteristics. We just have to figure out what they are. Is it cognitive flexibility? Should we do neuropsych testing? Is it the ability to look at something differently? So what are the traits and what are the contraindications? For example, is somebody that has just attachment issues or very complex traumas, is that someone that should be given psychedelics because the other approaches may be less effective? Or is that someone that might be very disrupted by psychedelics? And again, is that wild card the kind of therapeutic support they receive both before, during, and after? We don't know these answers. And so when we talk about the next phase of things, we have to understand that FDA approval, phase two trials, phase three trials, that's not the end game. That's the opening gambit. That is just our starting point where we can ask these questions because it won't be so difficult to do this research like it is now because of all the regulatory hoops that we have to go through and that these medications are in the hands of often industry sponsors that may have their own agenda of what kind of things should and shouldn't be studied. And that may or may not dovetail with what investigators or medical researchers think should and shouldn't be studied.
I want to pause and open up the floor for anyone that may have a question. I didn't get any text messages from anyone. So yes, just raise your hand. Anyone that has a question, I'll go there with the microphone.
Hi, my name is James. The last thing that you just said is really interesting. How those that are funding, like how they can influence the type of research that's done for their own gain. How is that regulated, if at all?
I don't know the answer to the question about how it's regulated. I think if you have a compound and you want to see if it works on an indication, you do some preliminary work to make sure that, you know, if you do phase one studies to make sure the compound is safe to give to people. And then you go through the process of phase two and then ultimately phase three, which so far only MAPS has achieved. So you can make any decision as a company that you want, but it has to be rational and it has to be based on something. So if we're talking outside the psychedelic space, you have a compound that you want to bring to market. Usually there will be a lot of animal studies and preliminary studies that are done to get at what does this drug do and what disease process is out there that matches what the effects of this drug are, or what animal model of depression, to the extent that you put credence in that stuff, will work. With psychedelics, you know, it was kind of a weird history because these medicines or compounds or drugs, whatever you want to call them, have been used before. These aren't drugs that have been developed. They're drugs that are known. They were banned. They have a checkered history, a lot of good, a lot of bad. So somebody had to regroup and say, okay, how are we going to go about testing the safety and efficacy for a particular indication? And, you know, the story of MDMA for PTSD was really that this is a gentle compound. Maybe it was used to assist underground and before it was banned, people to talk about traumas or difficult material, it opened them up. Of course, when these drugs were used to assist in psychotherapy, it wasn't exactly illegal, but it was on the lowdown or on the QT or whatever. People weren't so interested in specific psychiatric diagnoses. That's a pretty recent thing. Since 1980, really, is when people started with the focus on one diagnosis versus another. But people come to treatment, again, as we said before, because they have problems, usually psychosocial problems, usually relationship problems, as well as kind of mood issues. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
One more question.
Hi. Obviously, psychedelic therapy is not a traditional medication, right? It's multidimensional, and we're not trying to just fix a couple of molecules from being in a place where they shouldn't be. But let's just say that for some reason, you know, psychedelics don't fit into this two-dimensional pathway of trying to get a drug legal or classified as working for a certain problem. And it doesn't, maybe it doesn't pass the test. We're all excited about this renaissance. We're all sitting here because we feel that something's going to happen. What would you say is the biggest thing in the way that's going to get in the way of the goal that we all really wanted to see?
I think you probably have stronger opinions on that.
That's why I want you to answer it.
It's a complex field, right? It's not merely drug development. It's drug policy reform. Brett Waters is here from Reason for Hope, who is advocating at the congressional level with federal politicians about the challenges of the DEA schedule classification system, which I think is what you were alluding to making research so burdensome, is the hoops that you have to jump through as a result of that. There is the wave of excitement and enthusiasm built on combination of promising scientific results that are turning into a commercial narrative, that's turning into a policy reform narrative. So I don't know how to talk about this. It's really complicated and complex. And so I think the classic fear is that somebody's going to jump off a building and it's going to ruin this whole thing. So the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse acknowledged that the train has left the station on all of these fronts.
I think my biggest fear is that we are outpacing the data, that we're just doing things that we think are right or that we want to do without the evidence to support it. And I don't think that ultimately will serve us well. And so everyone's in a rush. It's very exciting. We don't have a lot of solutions. People don't really understand how to get mental health services, even regular ones. It really remains a big mystery to most people what they should do when they actually have a trauma or a psychological problem or depression. And this is being held up as the big solution. And we don't really know whether it's reversing anything that is biologically disrupted. I'm attracted to this approach for just that reason. I think this idea of trying to fix molecules or trying to fix biologic alterations that may or may not be the cause of symptoms is refreshing to me, that this is more of an assist of a psychotherapeutic process in mental health. But I think that we do need to collect the data. And yes, I do want that to be easier, but at the same time, I do have some concerns about legalization.
That's what you mean by getting ahead of the data?
In part. I mean, the argument that these are natural substances and they've been used for thousands of years in ceremony in indigenous practices may or may not be relevant to whether these compounds are safe for how we're going to use them today and who we're going to use them to. 2 out of 5 people in this country have a mental health condition. So even if you think that these substances should be available and they're perfectly safe for people that don't have a mental health problem or aren't vulnerable in some way, you still have to worry about those 2 out of 5. You know what percentage of this country has a trauma? That would be close to 90%, 70% before COVID. So if we think that psychedelics may bring out traumas that have not necessarily been processed, should we not worry? Now, that doesn't mean I don't think that it should be legalized. I certainly think it should be decriminalized. There's not even a question. But what have we put in place for people that want to try these approaches for a mystical experience or recreation, but then instead they get a trauma from when they were 5 years old surfacing? What provisions have we made in places where we want to legalize these compounds to prevent harm reduction? Where can somebody go to really talk about this? There are projects like the Fireside Project, but that's the only one that I know of. They're not going to be able to handle this entire country should the need arise. And so, you know, as we petition Congress and try to do the good work that we're doing, we should also be trying to figure out what our plan is. I get asked a lot, how hard is it to establish research in psychedelics in my settings, academic settings, or VA? What you spend a lot of time doing is talking to the institutional review board about what your contingency plan is to make sure people are safe. You don't get into philosophical discussions about whether psychedelics should or should not have been banned. That didn't happen to me even once. What they want to know is, what are you going to do when an adverse event happens? And so I would just challenge our field to ask the same question. What are we going to build so that we can make sure that everybody is safe when they try these potentially extraordinary medicines that can potentially be life-altering?
Another potentially contrarian take on this is that one of the perils is that we move from a place in the cycle where there's hype to the opposite. And what I mean by this is that even MAPS, which is a nonprofit, the cost of running clinical trials is gigantic, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And so if there's no narrative around the potential of these medicines to actually have a positive change, there will be no money flowing, either in a private or nonprofit, you know, place. And so it's an interesting dance between the hype and not getting ahead of ourselves and the belief that there's a there and it's worth funding that research from, you know, any possible place, NIH to kind of donations to for-profit companies also giving it a try, so to speak. And so that's one interesting point. And then the other one is that if we think about how psychedelics were used from indigenous cultures, it's always been pretty regulated, right? Like, these things are not a free for all. And so again, with legalization or decrim and or the medical model or the Oregon model, it's important to come back to the idea of, we do have best practices on how these medicines were used for millennia. And the answer is usually not. You can do it anytime, anywhere, in any way you want. At least that's not what we've learned. I want to bring us back to the point of, what have we learned from the clinical trials? And where I'm secretly trying to go is, people will seek coaches, therapists, practitioners. And I'm trying to find tools to give to everyone that may be interested in that, right? And we could call that harm reduction. So one question is, what does good psychedelic therapy look like? Are there any types of modalities that are used, some modalities that work better than others? And this goes full circle to the idea of supporting the patient's process, right? And so maybe, Rachel, you can start.
Well, I think that you have to know who's taking the psychedelic and why. And you start with that. What is your intention? Why? And what is your history? I mean, hopefully people will know enough to ask about whether somebody's also taking an antidepressant, basic question like that, or whether they have a trauma history, which is a very invasive question to ask somebody when you're not a clinician and just in the service of trying to facilitate psychedelic work. The concern would be that you can just go to someone in a very separate context from any therapy that you might be having with someone else. I mean, we talk about in mental health about the warm handoff. Sometimes a clinician is treating a patient, but the patient requires a very specialized treatment that only someone else knows how to give. So the patient will refer to a specialist for maybe 10 or 12 sessions and then go back. But the ideal way to do it is to really integrate it into the therapy so that there can be a handoff to the specialist and then a return handoff. I don't think that we have answers to these questions. People are very curious about using psychedelics. A lot of people have had positive experiences. I don't know whether negative experiences are being discussed at the same level, and I don't know who's having them. And I don't know if there's a way that we can know beforehand, you know, it's like with cannabis, right? For most people, they will enjoy cannabis. It's now legal in many states. It's not federally legal. It's completely normalized. But then you'll be sharing the now legal cannabis that you have with someone who will say, oh, no, no, it makes me really, really paranoid. I'm not taking this, right? So that's because almost everyone tried it at once in their lives during college or something like that. And so people come to either be attracted to it or repelled by the idea. But we don't have this with psychedelics. We don't know. There are a lot of things that we don't know.
Zach, well, anything else that you have to add?
Yeah, I was just going to add there's sort of a context upon which this conversation is happening, and that is the state of mental health care in the U.S. or broadly right now. There's this concept of mental health parity, which state laws and federal laws are established so that insurers are required to cover mental health care to the same rate they would cover orthopedics or cardiology or something like that. There's a chronic undercoverage of mental health, as I understand it. And many therapists are leaving the insurance system altogether because the demand for their services outweighs the bullshit they have to put up with to be in the insurance system. So this is sort of like one of the pieces of the puzzle that I think is really interesting, and I don't have a solution for it or pretend to think I have one, but there is a chronic undersupply of therapists for things as they are now.
Anyone else has any questions?
So my name is Emily. I had a big question on the role that Big Pharma plays into just policy, and are they working against you or are they working with you? Because antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication, that's some of the biggest medications on the market at the moment. So if you do make advances with the psychedelic therapy, you're eventually making competition to them in that market. So are they working against you in the term regards of policy and with government?
Right now, it's important to work with industry if we want to see how these psychedelic assisted therapeutic approaches work in particular indications, because they're the ones that are holding the medicines and developing the overall strategies and negotiating with the FDA. I don't think that we're going to be replacing the standard of care so quickly, mm-hmm. not for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And it will be a good problem to have if we do. So I don't think other drug companies are like shivering with fear over this, because there's a long way to go. But I don't like to demonize industry or really anyone. I think conducting clinical trials is really hard work. Negotiating with the FDA is hard work. And as an academic, I couldn't possibly take this kind of work on without an industry partner. And so the best thing would be to have a checks and balances system to make sure that academics are not, we say, in the pocket of their industry sponsors, and that data are able to be shared and transparent, and that industry adheres to the ethical standards of the academic institutions that it collaborates with. And hopefully one day there's data sharing, although I'm not naive about how difficult that is when you're trying to have IP and all that. But hopefully we can develop ways of moving forward in a way that's equitable, just, transparent, and provides honest data.
Maybe I can answer it more from wearing my investor hat. So as of 2018, 24 of the 30 best-selling drugs came from either academic spinouts or small biotech companies. They didn't come from Big Pharma. Then Big Pharma ended up acquiring those companies or partnering with those companies. So if we're just looking at, you know, what's happened in other fields, it's more likely that Big Pharma will come and get involved in a way, but it's just like the playbook for other parts of healthcare and life sciences as well. And my experience working and partnering with different companies in the field is the same. I don't know any companies that we've invested in that are not in conversations with different pharma players in one way or another. It's still very early. And I think that's one of the overarching themes of tonight. We're very early in that process, but that's how I'm seeing it from my standpoint.
Hi, I'm Caroline. I was curious what role genetics play in evaluating the criteria to determine whether someone is qualified, specifically someone who maybe doesn't suffer from depression or mental illness, but has family members that do, and what the risk associated with that is.
Yeah, that's a very important question. People are very interested in what we call pharmacogenomics and even pharmacoepigenomics, just really understanding whether any predisposing factors are going to play a role in predicting your response. Many people stay away from psychedelics if they have a first-degree relative with psychosis. So whether that is warranted or not, I mean, it is a practice. This is why we need research. You know, we have to learn from bad outcomes that people have. And part of this kind of psychological autopsy has to do with asking these kinds of questions so that even if we don't go in studying this prospectively, we can build kind of database that really allows us to understand when somebody does have a more negative experience. But you see, the problem with that is that, you know, the language that we have adopted is not binary in terms of a positive or a negative experience. And a lot of times people undergo very difficult medication sessions, but in the hands of the proper therapist, a lot can be learned from it. They can salvage it. They can go somewhere as a result of that negative experience. Now, would they want to repeat the experience? And if they would have known to begin with, should they have taken the medicine? Maybe not. But what you're talking about is it contraindicated because of a certain genetic makeup that taking this medicine will make me worse or will induce a latent psychiatric condition? That's different than having a bad experience and then being in the hands of a skilled therapist. And the answer is we don't really know. And that is on our to-do list of things that we have to figure out as a field. But we also don't know it for other medications that we use in mental health. So I think that this is why the kind of post-approval surveillance that the FDA requires once a drug becomes FDA approved is so very, very important. As people do have experiences with these treatments, as they become more available, we have to collect these kind of data.
Hi, my question relates to the insurance industry. I think we all know that the insurance industry has a pretty long-term and difficult relationship between chronic disease and alternative remedies. And so I'd like to address how you see that progressing over the next 5 to 10 years. Insurance companies don't embrace medication that deals with long problems, and they prefer episodic intervention. So I'd like to hear your opinion on how that's going to play out.
Going back to the MAPS is the group that is furthest along the drug approval process. They're in the phase three of three phases of research before an FDA decision. People I talk to there tell me that they're in conversation with insurers and they expect that insurance will cover to label. So when the FDA approves a drug, it defines what's called a drug label, which is sort of the indication and the diagnosis for which it's been approved. And people at MAPS think that there is good possibility that MDMA-assisted therapy would be covered to label. The question, I think, is how readily is that adopted? Again, sort of going back to this idea of mental health parity and insurance coverage, there's kind of a historic and chronic undercoverage of mental health services. I would put it into, it's a big unknown and something that the field is watching and sort of will be waiting for.
To add to that, most of how healthcare costs have been billed, it's this idea of fee for service, right? Like there's an intervention and then you do that intervention and pharmacological or any other type and you get paid as a practitioner or as a clinician. And there's this other paradigm that's more outcomes-based, value-based care. And so the idea, if we can really capture what's the societal cost of someone that is experiencing depression, right? Then we can bake that into the real cost or the real potential advantages of something like MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, right? My hypothesis is a number there will look very different than if we're just comparing that to someone getting an SSRI, which costs virtually nothing from a drug perspective, but the societal cost of that person experiencing PTSD is huge.
And there's been some early research on this into the data from the MAPS phase 2 trial, and I think the first phase 3 trial, where you're seeing if intervention can save money by producing a better outcome over the lifetime of an individual. So that, I think, is what the concept of value-based or outcomes-based care is.
Exactly. And I think we're almost riding that wave at the same time that the psychedelic wave is coming, or is potentially coming to market. So, yeah. I want to end on a positive note. Each one of you, please tell me one thing you are looking forward or excited about the psychedelic field in the next few months.
Well, I'm very excited at how our training program for clinicians is going. We've now trained 120 therapists with MAPS, and 100 or so of these therapists are people that provide care to veterans. And so that is something that I'm super excited about, the enthusiasm of people who are connecting with this approach. And after the training, we just had our first in-person training, people will say that they can go back and listen to their patients in a very different way, just as a result of kind of learning about natural healing intelligence and following a patient's process. So I think that even for people for whom actually administering a psychedelic like MDMA is not imminent, not in the next few months, really conveying this new model of using a medication that helps facilitate a process is going to add a lot to the way that we treat trauma survivors.
One of the things that I'm following closely is what's called the right to try. There's a right to try law, which is intended to give people who are either at the end of life or have life-threatening illness access to drugs that are still in development. And there's a few groups that are working on clarifying whether or not psilocybin and other psychedelics would be eligible for that. And so whether or not that's getting ahead of the data, I'm not sure, but I think it's a really interesting feature of this landscape that I'm excited to see where it goes.
Amazing. Rachel, Zach, thank you so much for your time. It's 8:30 p.m. and we're still here. Thank you, Liz, also for putting this together. And thank you, Greg, for basically doing half of it.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can tweet at us or find us on the gram at BusinessTripFM. And if you're building a company in psychedelics, hit us up. My email is greg@businesstrip.fm. I'm your host, Greg Kubin, alongside Matthias Serebrinski. Producer and editor is Jonathan Davis. Sound design and engineering came from Zach Frank. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.